Hello, and welcome to Darker Corners, the best and only Justice League Dark show. This is episode 12. I'm the host, Nick Antoine. Keeping the demon in the bottle 12 moons hence. Here's to 12 more. Oh, wait, hold on. Old business. Use it. New business. Don't abuse it. This is JLD issue number 12. It's War for the Books of Magic, part 1. It was written by Jeff Lemire, art by Michael Janin. Probably just Michael Janin, but you know. Yeah. Colors by Ulysses Arayla, lettered by Rob Lee, cover by Ryan Sook. The associate editor was Katie Kubert, which I think the second entity that's summoned is a nod to someone I'm assuming is related to her. I don't want to cast aspersions. It could just be a similar last name. And the main editor was Brian Cunningham. This is an intriguing issue, being that I, you know, coming to it after the fact. When it was going down, I saw this is just continuing, you know, this, oh, we're continuing on from the previous issue, and the next one is just going to continue into the next one, as you expect in a graphic novel series. After the fact, realizing that any graphic novel series that started up as soon as the Flashpoint had ended, you know, with the Justice League and Action Comics, Superman, Batman, Detective Comics, The Flash, Wonder Woman, there was a bunch that started off right when the Flashpoint happened. By issue 12, the next one would not have been 13, but instead a zero issue that ended up becoming an origin story for that particular graphic novel series. So I did not know that by the time I got to the end of this, the first time I read it, it would not be leading directly into the next issue. You know, I wanted to say, oh, no, I need this next story. Not realizing I had to wait 2 months to get, you know, the next month would be the zero issue, and then the following month would be issue number 13. So just know that going into this, that, well, if you're listening to this and reading along, which some people do, it only takes like 20 minutes to read it, so you can, you know, go through it and pause and different things, but you've probably gotten to the end and saw like, oh, it continues in issue zero technically, even though the zero issue for every graphic novel series in the DC New 52 multiverse takes place before the events of that particular run of the series. So by the time you get to the zero issue, it's going to take place before Justice League Dark issue 1. And then when we get to Justice League Dark 13, it's going to pick up where JLD 12 left off. So just keep that in mind. Some things are going to happen, and then the next episode you're going to hear stuff that has nothing to do with this and everything to do with this. So we get a little bit of a backstory on Dr. Mist. We get some sympathy for the devil, as it were. I was spot on with my assumption that it was sub-Saharan Africa, the dialect, that it was sub-Saharan African dialect. It stated that his real name being Nomo Balewa, he was from Uganda, and he was a doctor, helping people who could not help themselves because of, you know, military coups and the like, the unfortunate reality of a lot of Africa, especially sub-Saharan and below. Some events occur that cause the death of a loved one, and he wants to use the magic at his disposal, be it the magic that he has, you know, is privy to, and magic that is, you know, passed down by ancestors and different magical practitioners, occultists from his country, and I would assume surrounding countries in Africa, to try and bring this individual back. And we see that that's the reasoning why he ended up needing to get a hold of what I can say now, but I completely forgot the name of, unfortunately. I know the name of the thing they're ultimately trying to get, but let's just say the golden box, and not the Pandora's box thing, but it's because Pandora's box, it's a skull, it's totally different, in the DC multiverse. this particular box, the image that was shown between Merlin and Mordru, when it was shown why what was created, the box that was used as the key, in essence, the key to find it. I guess you could say, the maps. That's what this particular box does. It kind of becomes a 3D map, in essence, inside the mind of the wielder, if they can open this box. The box, when it opens, it kind of looks like the Lament configuration. It's very cool. I'm fascinated by that stuff, if you didn't already know. So we kind of are given his motivations as to why he's one of the people trying to go after this particular object. And we then have, you know, everyone coming together, trying to stop Felix Faust and his plans dead in their tracks. Zatanna has her spell shot back at her, which is pretty cool. The onomatopoeia that comes up is the actual word, bewilder them. I was not going to say it, but I was point not to. Constantine comes back to consciousness, and they all decide, oh, okay, yeah, we're going to try and figure out some way to, figure out both where Felix Faust is and the object we've ultimately been trying to find. Steve Trevor said, he's like, oh, yeah, you can split it up. And, yeah, so Black Orchid and John Constantine go to the House of Mystery, and everybody else, Zatanna, Deadman, everybody else, I guess that is everybody else, Zatanna and Deadman, I guess it would be Steve Trevor if he went along. They went to, this is not spoiling it, it's a swamp in Gotham. Slaughter Swamp, to be precise. Yeah, that's not spoiling anything at all. Not because I'm like, oh, Batman's going to show up. I don't think he shows up at all. But it's just the fact that it's like the particular city and some events that end up going down. Don't want to spoil it. But anyway, they end up going to this place. So they split up. Meanwhile, Madame Xanadu was still trying to convince the individual. She was trying to convince, hey, man, you should like really help us out. The guy's like, look, I went through a lot of drama, and I realized I can't have magic around me, man. So I had to let it go. And not like in a frozen way. He literally had to physically let that stuff out of his body so he could just be normal. And then we find ourselves back at the temple of Felix Faust in Peru. The same temple that was there, let's say, was issue 9? No, it was... Yeah, issue 9, because it was the beginning of the Black Room. And this is issue 12, so it was the beginning of the Black Room arc. It was before... It was after Rise of the Vampires. Okay, yeah. It's continuity, people. We see a group of people inside, Felix Faust being one of them. They're inside the temple. And funnily enough, the panel right before it, creepily enough, the same people that were reported dead by S.H.I.E.L.D. I'm so sorry. I'm not editing that out. You know why? Because S.H.I.E.L.D. got bolstered up because Sam Jackson rocks as an actor. He just does. He rocks as an actor. His filmic presence is awe-inspiring and something to behold. Thusly, S.H.I.E.L.D. had to be bolstered. It had to be, just because, you have to justify having Nick Fury everywhere. So, S.H.I.E.L.D. is on the case. Colby Smulders is an awesome actress, and she ended up becoming, Maria Hill. So you have two agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. You kind of have to continue with that, like you expanded, thusly, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I've never watched the show, not because I'm biased, and never watched an entire episode. I tried watching the first episode, and it just felt like you had to love it to want to continue down that road. And as I've stated in a previous episode, I didn't love Avengers like that. I still thought it was like 5. Like I said, for everything else, 5 out of 5, 10 out of 10, whatever you want to say, 4 stars. 4 out of 4 stars, rather. It was still great. It was just, it wasn't what I was looking for. By that point, I still hadn't found what I was looking for. So I moved on. I hit that ass, and I moved on. The thing is, Argus seems to be more necessary than S.H.I.E.L.D. And Argus needed to be reintroduced because of all the different events that started unfolding since the Flashpoint. Especially with the Justice League International, you know, it made sense to have a liaison because the regular Justice League group was not affiliated with the government. And they were trying to make it as real world as possible, given that the cities are, you know, Gotham City and Coast City and Metropolis and the Mascara. You know, they're places that don't technically exist. They're amalgamations of real-world destinations. You know, in essence, Gotham City being the seedier side of New York and Chicago, which is real-life location, is supposed to be northern New Jersey. And Metropolis, Boston, technically. It's just, they're a hodgepodge of the different things, the different cities in the real world. So it's easy for someone to make that mistake, you know, to be thinking S.H.I.E.L.D. if they, you know, read both houses worth of publishing houses worth of graphic novels, to be thinking S.H.I.E.L.D. and say Argus, or to be thinking Argus and say S.H.I.E.L.D. just because they serve the same purpose. But in my opinion, Argus is highly more effective. More highly effective is definitely more effective than S.H.I.E.L.D. and that S.H.I.E.L.D. is known for Nick Fury. And that's about it. That Nick Fury and the Howling Commandos, yes, the Howling Commandos may have eventually become agents in one way or form of S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, by association, but whenever you would look at, and you know, the older issues of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., those graphic novels, you weren't paying attention to everyone else. It was, oh, what's Nick Fury, who is he culling together for this team? And if I had to have a choice between wanting to read a story about Nick Fury or wanting to read one about Steve Trevor, I'd want to read one about Steve Trevor. Because Nick Fury, you know, he's basically Captain America with less heart. Yes, I'm sure there are times where he's shown to have more humanity than most in the graphic novels, but for the most part, he's following orders and or making up orders for other people to follow, which is cool if you like that kind of soldieristic, militaristic approach to battle. But there's subtle nuances that can be had in a battle and made because of how you size up your enemy. And Steve Trevor is so plagued by his own humanity, especially in the New 52, with him being in essence scorned in one way, shape, or form by Wonder Woman, and then having to watch, you know, on public display the romance of Superman and Wonder Woman. Clearly that must damage his ego. That that frustration is then turned towards running Argus a certain way. To have all of those motivations there, under the fact that Amanda Waller runs all this stuff, that makes it the coolest thing in the world. You can't get past that. And you add to that that Argus is quite heavily influenced on Arrow, on the CW, Wednesdays, 8 p.m. You can't freaking beat that. You can't beat it. Sorry, it's amazing. So yes, it was a slip because they're both what is it? Anagrams? Yeah, I don't remember what S.H.I.E.L.D. stands for. But bottom line, I meant Argus. Argus had reported to Steve Trevor, and Steve Trevor had relayed to the JLD that. Everyone, I'm sorry, and Steve Trevor had relayed to Felix Faust that everyone was dead, and the only person that was left was Felix Faust, semi-conscious, and the JLD were missing. So for us to come onto this first image here of Peru, and it's outside, and it's showing that the bodies are still there, it shows the carelessness with which Felix Faust operates, with him being inside the temple, going about his business, not even deciding to maybe do some magic and, you know, boogly boogly. All the corpses are gone. None of that. He's there with this mysterious individual who has the same tattoo that bugged out Felix Faust in a previous episode. We get a little bit more on that later on. Not later on in this issue, later on in the series. Needless to say, he's still showing some fear. He's cowering. His mannerisms are showing, you know, head held low. I mean, you know, you draw things for a reason. The individuals are stating their intent all of it being personal reasons, nothing having to do with helping the greater good, as you would expect from someone that's in the supervillain camp. But it's not even trying to help their teammates or their comrades. There's almost no honor amongst these. These guys all have their own private agendas. The place where the object that everyone is trying to get is located is name-checked here, but I will go more in-depth into it once we get into JLD 13, because the location is quite prominent, not only in... You know what? Let's not even go there. It's a good thing. And you're probably, again, you're probably burning like, oh, you ass, why don't you talk about it now? I'm not going to talk about that. I'm talking about the next episode. Also, the identity of this particular individual that's spearheading Felix Faust's side of this acquisition is prominent for a reason. And when I did some research, I found out that there's a reason why this individual is prominent. This individual, in particular, ends up going on his own quest to, quote-unquote, guess I'll just have to buy a house of my own, when he finds out from Felix Faust that Constantine controls the House of Mystery. So anyone that was listening to a previous episode or knows any of the history of the House of Mystery knows where that's going. As said house travels, quote-unquote, through limbo at transdimensional speeds, we see a conversation between Constantine and Black Orchid, that both of them kind of just going over their respective origins. And we see a flashback with some familiar characters sitting at a round table. And no, I don't mean anything having to do with King Arthur and his court. But it does reveal some aspects of Constantine's character, both during the story as well as after. As well as Black Orchid's, I don't want to say inhumanity, but purposeful denial of emotions, not making it seem as if she's totally shocked by what she's just heard, even though she clearly is. Those two end up arriving in Slaughter Swamp, and it's overrun by brush. And he's, you know, Constantine's like, okay, there's clearly some crap going on here. And we flash over to the portal that was opened by Zatanna, where Deadman and her have arrived in Peru to go confront Felix Faust. And they are stopped by something, a gigantic tree thingamabob named Black Briar Thorn. Black Briar Thorn was created by Len Wein and Joe Kubert. This is that thing I was talking about. It seemed like a nod to Miss Kubert here. He's known for having the abilities of magical powers, air and wind manipulation, creating illusions, shifting his size, having regeneration abilities, and extensive control over a variety of plant life. Now, the origin is apparently he was a high priest of the ancient druids of Cymru. That's C-Y-M-R-U. It's one of those things, like, I've seen that word so many times. I know a lot of other people do, like, oh, such and such is from Cymru. Cymru is Wales. Like, I didn't know that until last year. It's just, if I'm not mistaken, the Welsh pronunciation of Wales. But Black Briar Thorn basically is just a Welsh druid. It's not basically, it's what he is a Welsh druid. For some reason, if you don't already know, a lot of Americans, I feel, know this by now, but the United Kingdom, the main countries, are on that, those are the four countries on that island. Scotland, Ireland, Wales, and the United Kingdom, and Great Britain. Yeah, it's Great Britain. Yeah, because the UK is the United Kingdom. London is the city. There is no, it's not just Britain. Yeah, see, I'm an American. It shows you exactly what the hell I'm talking about. Yeah, so that country, it's on the bottom is Great Britain. And how could I say this? If you're looking at America, technically, and this is not equitable at all, but technically, I don't even know my states that well. Let's zoom out. Let's zoom out. Technically, Mexico would be Britain, and then California would be Wales, and then Scotland would be Texas, and then Ireland, technically given their social distance, would be North Dakota. That's a great way to put it. But they're all still on the same island. Blackbriar, as it says here, while his entire sect is massacred by attacking Roman forces, he ends up basically just running away, going into the forest. And because he was trying to make sure that nobody would see him, he ended up turning himself into solid wood, and he hid amongst a bunch of trees. As it says here, unfortunately for him, the agony of his dying comrades created a geological upheaval which buried his newly arboreal form underground, his new wooden form. Now as this piece of wood, it buried him underground because of the agony of his comrades dying around him. So apparently about 1,000 years later, his body was exhumed from the ground by an archaeologist, and it ended up becoming displayed in the Gotham City Museum of History. And apparently so, when the moonlight strikes the statue on the night of its unveiling, Blackbriar was revived and began to wreak havoc upon the museum and its patrons. Stop there, just in case you want to read more. I don't want to kill it, man. There's no point. He ends up coming up again later on, definitely. But for the time being, I felt like it was definitely worth knowing a little bit about who this individual is. He's not just coming out of nowhere. His first appearance being in DC Comics Presents 66, February of 1984. He's an intriguing character. There's a lot of stuff that could be dug up about the individual. But, you know, read the graphic novels that he's associated with. It would probably be a lot more interesting of a journey than just wikiing it up. But as we get back to the story, as Blackbriar Thorn attacks Deadman and Zatanna, we cut back over to Constantine and Black Orchid as they make their way towards what they believe to be the location of what they're looking for. Again, you know what it is, but try not to kill it for people that are cheating. We'll get into it once we get into it. But they're stopped. They're stopped by an individual named Black Boris, Cannibal King of the Fire Trolls. Now, that's a very Dungeons and Dragons type moniker to have. Had never heard of this individual before. I knew I just saw him in this particular graphic novel series. The little bit of info I find on him, as Black Boris's alias is Cannibal King, so he's not just the Cannibal King. He's like, his name is I don't know. His name is Cassius Clay, and his name is Muhammad Ali. There you go. The same individual, just you call him something different depending on what year it is. His first appearance was in this issue, and apparently he's in 4 issues in total. He can control fire, and he has super strength, and he's a bit. He can have some feral tendencies, apparently. What I'd like to point out is what ends up coming next. Because again, you don't want to go too much into what's said and who does what, and spoiling the experience for people that went out of their way to pay the 99 cents to actually see this stuff. We get a first appearance, if I'm not mistaken, in the New 52 of both the House of Secrets. Again, that's that twin house to the House of Mystery, the House of Secrets, that in pre-Flashpoint was specifically Abel's house, whereas House of Mystery was Cain's house, the House of Secrets is Abel's house. It is their houses. If there is an actual deed, probably some magical deed, it's got their names on it, even though the houses, the respective houses, will have their own respective caretakers or squatters, if you will. The individual that was in the temple in Peru with Felix Faust has now found himself at the doorstep of the House of Mystery, and who answers? None other than Dr. Occult. So we're basically being shown here, I don't know the backstory, and I'm sure there's a lot of it, but he's clearly one that, let's just say, if this takes place, quote unquote, in 2012, in sometime in 2011, he was the owner of both the House of Secrets and the House of Mystery, and just resided in whichever one he wanted to at whichever time. It was mentioned before, if I'm not mistaken, it was issue 10, could be issue 9, but in a previous episode, that Constantine had Yes, issue 9. Constantine had won the House of Mystery from Dr. Occult and Father Time in a poker game. I don't know what Father Time has to do with it, other than probably just there to play the game, but whatchamacallit, Dr. Occult was the one that actually had the key, and he was just naming, like, oh yeah, these are the people I was playing poker with, but they just didn't mention exactly who it was at the time. We are shown now that it was Dr. Occult. Now, I had mentioned a little bit earlier that Dr. Occult was a part of the Trenchcoat Brigade, which had included the Phantom Stranger and John Constantine, that had came out in 1999, which, again, you know, you should go and read it. It's a quick read. It's a graphic novel. It's definitely worth it. And Mr. E, right, is the other individual in it. But some intriguing aspects to this character that I didn't go over before because I knew he would come up again. His alter ego is Richard Occult. Notably, one of his aliases is Dr. Mystic. He still is capable of astral projection, hypnosis, illusion creation, and telekinesis. Now, again, as I had said before, the earliest in-continuity character in DC Comics history. He is the oldest character. If Superman is the first superhero, Batman is the first, in essence, Superman. And Wonder Woman is the first superheroine. And Dr. Occult is the first enhanced being, the first meta-human. And he comes before all of them. Okay, really didn't mean to make any puns there. He appeared in graphic novels before all these guys and gals. As it states, New Fun Comics number 6 in 1935, he was a supernatural detective, which was common then, you know, right before the war, and I would say right up until World War II. It definitely happened in the 40s and 50s. You'd had it more in actual movies, black and white movies. But when it came to literature, having detective novels, and now by this point, hard-boiled detective novels, which is basically a hard-headed detective that's going about a case, sure that their theory is correct, and either finding out that the theory is correct but not being able to solve the case, or finding out their theory was incorrect and yet being able to solve the case. This was a shift from the types of detective novels that would come out in the late 1800s and early 1900s, when the detective was what Batman became, which was all versions of one way, shape, or form Sherlock Holmes, a detective who knew the ins and outs of the case and basically was just carrying the reader along with them to the end point. That's very reductionist of Sherlock Holmes, and I don't mean to make Sir Arthur Conan Doyle seem like a simple writer. He was anything but. But there definitely was a difference between the types of detectives that were rolled out to the general populace, to the readership, in those three different eras, if you will. The omnipotent private eye of Sherlock Holmes' ilk, the Dick Tracy-esque, or I guess now just say Dr. Occult-esque detective, you know, that kind of knew what was going on, but wasn't exactly sure if their hunch was right. Or you get to, in essence, I would say the modern era, which was pretty much World War II and forward, which was you could pretty much get either one of the two. Sometimes you can get both in one person. So you can get a detective who knows everything in and out because they have a theory, and then everything could be thrown off, like in The Usual Suspects. Or you can have a detective who has no idea what's going on, but they normally do, and they're being led down some road, and they have no idea where it's going, and that's akin to Chinatown. People enjoy mysteries. They really do, and I think it's underplayed because they're hard to write. That's why people don't realize they love them as much as they do. But just look at Mad Men and how long that's gone on because of the mystery of so many characters, or a True Detective and how well that did because it was a mystery show, a suspense. I haven't seen any of these shows, but The Killing, you know, or there's this other one, I don't remember what it's called. But then there's also Fargo. I heard that's really good. I haven't gotten onto that yet. And Hannibal, saw the first season of that, great stuff. All these shows that are, they're suspense, they're thrillers, it's mysterious, you don't know what's going on, you don't know what's around the next corner. Everybody loves that. It's hard to write, so that's why everything else comes out, and people get aggravated, so like, oh, I wanna be challenged, I want something Agatha Christie-esque, something Doyle-esque, you know, and then when it comes out, everyone's like, oh, thank goodness, my blue balls, my purple ovaries are relieved. I don't know. Is that what it is? Purple ovaries? I'm going to call it that. Purple ovaries. As stated, Dr. Occult was a supernatural detective whose detecting style was very much in the style of Sam Spade, but he just so happened to have supernatural abilities as well. He was assisted by his butler, Jenkins, in one adventure. His girlfriend slash partner was called Rose Psychic, and she appeared in his first adventure and then returned again later in the series. There's a lot of different, a lot more information here that goes into where he came from, what he was doing. Guess we could just leave it at that. Other than, let's just say, his origin is 1899 New Year's Eve, so it would have been, you know, New Year's Day, it would have been 1900. He and Rose Psychic had been rescued by a shadowy group called the Seven from ritual murder at the hands of a satanic cult, and then insanity ensued. So, you know, I'd highly recommend going back and checking this stuff out. Of course, the artwork and the prose will reflect the pathos of the time. You're going to get art that's the colors are a little bit bolder, they're a little bit more primary, and there's more space between lines, whether it's the lines on the body, the face, the actual clothing, or the space between lines in the background and foreground objects. It's going to be wider for all kinds of reasons, and the way that the characters talk, the way that the narrator talks to you as the reader is going, depending, I mean, I haven't been to this one, I haven't gone down this road, but it's going to be one of two things. It's either going to be very broad and talk to you like you're a child, or it's going to use words that seem like you're watching an episode of Leave It to Beaver. Got a lot of, you know, terms that seem like it's like, oh, these are the, you know, beatniks, or these are the people using the slang of the day, because we're in a city and it's like a slum or a speakeasy or a pool hall, you know, it's expect that, but go into it with that kind of excitement, like, okay, I'm going to see a totally different side of Americana by reading this. I recommend it. Okay, I recommend that. I haven't even read it, and you know, just to bolster it, it was created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the guys who created Superman, so it's bound to have some kind of weight and resonance behind the stories, you know, why wouldn't it? And again, because you want to make sure that we don't spoil things oh so much, we will leave the conclusion up in the ether. What I will say, though, is that there's an object that's shown that elicits the Umbrella Corporation, and unless it gets resolved in a later issue, which I'm not sure that it does, please email me and let me know what that's all about at darkercornerscast@gmail.com. This this particular episode, I would say the theme was selfish acquisition. Yeah, that's what I would say. You had, in essence, Felix Faust's team desperately trying to just gain power. Felix Faust, in particular, just, you know, the typical Skeletor thing. I just need more power. And maybe not Skeletor, maybe Mumra. Trying to get power just to have power. And then you have Constantine's side, which, you know, John Constantine just being him, like, I just want more. I already have the House of Secrets. I'm sorry, I already have the House of Mystery. What more can I have? Oh, yeah, I can have this object that we're all going after. That would be really awesome. I'll take that, too. On top of the fact that I got all this cool stuff from the Black Room because Steve Trevor was, you know, desperate and needed help. Madame Xanadu going after the individual she's going after because she wants to make sure that the visions she's seeing don't actually come to being, which is typical of prophetic individuals in literature. They are selfish in the fact that they don't allow their prophecies to enact themselves unless they're an augur in an ancient Greek story. For the most part, they're not displaced or removed, either far removed or closely removed from the prophecy. and they're just, you know, spilling information, you know, like with the prophet that's told Julius Caesar in William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, beware the Ides of March. That prophet didn't step in and say, hey man, the Ides of March are going to be real messed up, so why don't you go stay at my villa for all of March, just in case somebody decides they want to come around and, I don't know, stab you in the back? That would suck, right? No, that's not what a prophet is supposed to do. A psychic, they're supposed to just forewarn, they're not supposed to try and change things. And this individual is trying to change things, clearly in an attempt to gain respect from her own mentor that was shown in that bizarre other realm in the previous issues. I want to say it was issues 6 and 7, definitely somewhere between 6 and 8, but 6 and 7, issue 6 and 7. And then, you know, as well, Dr. Mist, who is attempting to resurrect a loved one who is no longer around. He's continuing on this journey to get that object because that's all he wants. He doesn't care how it affects anyone around him or the cost or toll on his own body. He's just like, uff it, man. This is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to do. I haven't talked about what had been occupying my time too much, just because, like I said, this podcast isn't self-congratulatory. It's rooting for, it's cheerleading on the awesomeness that is Detective Comics Comics. I'm not Jimmy Two Times. But I will say that the film is completely done. It's been done for a little bit. Sent it out to some festivals, cut together a different film before, well, I cut together a piece of it and sent it out to one festival in particular, a competition, the Project Greenlight, but then I sent out something else, you know, an actual film to a bunch of festivals after the fact, let that go out into the ether, see if anybody actually wants to see it. That's the whole point. You know, a lot of artists will say, like, oh, you know, let me not even say that, because that's hot food. And a lot of directors will say, like, oh, no, I don't care if anyone sees my stuff. But it's like, nah, and we kind of do this because we want you to see it. Now, you may despise it, and that's a whole different can of worms, but we kind of hope that you enjoy it. You might not love it, you might not even like it, but it's like, oh, okay, it wasn't a complete waste of time. That's all we really hope for, that you get whatever the message is out of it. Won't tell you the name of it yet. It's not like there isn't a name. There is one. I'm not going to tell you. Well, the other one was called Riverside. That was last year's film. But that's still doing the rounds as of yet. There hasn't been an official unveiling of that film. There are a couple of festivals that it was better to release them to the festivals this year. Kind of do a 1-2 punch, you know, to do the 2013 film and the 2014 film. Released to multiple festivals simultaneously. It kind of tests the waters to see if people enjoy the sensibilities of a film that's mostly a suspense. You know, and it's got some jokes here and there in it, but it's not jokes. It's like, oh, that's kind of funny, but it stays suspenseful, and drug use and all kinds of weird stuff, and sexual innuendos. A film like that to a complete sci-fi displaced film, but made from the same director. Just, I don't know, just give people a taste of two different things. That is just like, oh yeah, here's this film. So yeah, all that stuff's done. When something comes of it, I'll speak more on it. When I can't speak more on it, I definitely will. Should I talk about that other thing? No. I will say, I've said it before, and I probably mentioned it more on Constant Tome, Calvin Ellis's books. Just because we scratch each other's backs. I'm not exactly sure how he's been scratching my back lately, but I know he doesn't listen to this, so it doesn't matter. He's not offended. But he's good at what he does. You check out Cairo. That was the first one. It's technically the first book in that universe. It's not a series. You'll understand when you read it. It's broken up into two parts, that book, inside the book. The first part is one story. The second part is another story. But they occur in the same universe, same time period. If I'm not mistaken, it's like the same week, but it's just different characters interacting with different situations. They never cross paths. It probably would have been cool to read, but that's not what the case is. The second book, Someday, Sumdei, semicolon, someday, semicolon, the fallen, someday, the fallen. That's the first book in a series, which he's told me is 7 books, 7 to 8 books. It's not finished. He only released the first one. But that one, it's connected to Cairo. It happens in the same universe, but it happens at a different time. Not like, oh, it happens 5,000 years in the future. No, no, no. I think it's like 2 years later. It's a different character. But, you know, it refers to events that occurred in Cairo, you know. But check them out. It's 99 cents on Amazon.com. And I know people can get stuff for free online. Just like I know you can get your graphic novels for free online. You could just as so easily, if someone was an a-hole about it, decide to upload Calvin's books online. And then you could just download them for free. I'm never going to give it away for free. That's doable because that's the century we live in. Piracy is prevalent. But because we still live in a pseudo-capitalistic society, we kind of have to support artists to the best of our abilities. So, like this individual, he could have went out of his way to try and get it into a hardcover printing kind of situation, and decided, oh, okay, I'm going to charge, you know, the prerequisite $20 to put this out, or get it soft cover first, which is never a good idea, people. And sell it for, you know, like if it's a smaller copy, $4.99, or if it's a bigger copy, sell it for like, you know, $8, something like that. But instead, just, you know, convenience, and to try and shift the burden of cost off of the, you know, you the reader, and onto the artist, take a hit, just so you can appreciate the art, just so you can get a piece of it into your brain. I think that's a pretty cool avenue to go down. So you might as well just, you know, be a patron of it. And if you don't like it, then, you know, just never support the person again, or support them later when you're like, oh, okay, I like them now, or they're better now, or whatever the case is. But, you know, don't just steal to steal, because it's not like every artist is their own corporation. Even if they might be a part of a company, or they own a company, whatever the case is, if they were a corporation, they wouldn't be trying so desperately, like he is, to whore themselves out on Amazon, to sell their souls that they digitally scribed to the masses in the hopes that they can continue to eat another day, to sleep in shelter, not a shelter, but sheltered, to drink clean water. I mean, it seems like obvious things, like, oh yeah, everyone can do that, but isn't, you know, just like a lot of different authors, you know, not every author is multitasked enough or multi-talented enough to be able to be an author and as well like a school teacher or an author and a barista or an author and a doctor, like to be able to do all those different things, to have those different mindsets split up. He's a guy that's a bit of a recluse, just kind of sits in his cabin. I mean, I'm assuming it's a cabin. Lives in Kansas. I haven't been there yet. We've talked a lot. He just kind of Stephen Kings it up. Not in it, his writing style, but in his necessity to be secluded, in the hopes that his, you know, his art will continue to sustain him. And his art is worth sustaining, from what I could tell. That's enough of me filleting that dude. As I mentioned already, you can check out the email address for the show. It's at darkercornerscast@gmail.com. As per usual, it's darkercornerscast@gmail.com. It's a whole slew of people, not really just me. You can follow the show on Twitter at Darker Corners. That's with a capital D and a capital C. It links you to the website or iTunes, just depending on the day of the week. And of course, you know, if you feel like it's a good idea at the moment, you can go ahead and rate the show on iTunes, where you found this thing called a podcast. You know, go ahead and give it 5 stars and be like, wow, this is totally different. You don't have to say like, oh, this is the greatest thing I ever heard, because it probably isn't. But just go ahead and just be like, oh man, you know what, this, I'm not mad that I actually wasted some time somewhere between, let's just say 45 minutes and 2 hours, depending on where you jumped onto this podcast, which hopefully you started at the beginning, because then everything else would make sense, like why I rant about the things that I rant about, and accentuate the aspects of these graphic novels that I accentuate, because I have tastes and preferences. Not that I have tastes, that would sound so condescending. I have certain tastes and preferences that dictate that I act the way that I do, using my words to hopefully stretch this out so that we actually hit 45 minutes, so that my previous statement actually rings true. This has been the 12th episode, and hopefully the stretching has worked. I have been Nick Antoine. You have been the unwitting listener. Thank you for listening. Step into the dark.